Well, hello and welcome. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and thanks for joining us for another Face to Face today. Very happy to welcome our guests right here in the studios in Tehran, and that would be Ms. Cynthia McKinney, who is joining us. And of course, she's a former congresswoman in the United States and also a former presidential candidate of the Green Party. Thanks so much for being here. It's great to have you here.
Well, it's a pleasure for me because you have been a voice and a face that I have seen through cyberspace, and now I actually get to be here in the studio with you.
Well, believe me, it's all our pleasure right here to have you. Well, Cynthia, let's start off. You've been here in Iran now for a couple of days with this anti-terrorism seminar. Just a brief explanation about your overall thoughts about that seminar, and we'll go from there.
Well, I think it was a wonderful experience for me. Of course, this is the first time I've ever been to Iran, and there are many perceptions out there, particularly in the United States, about the character of the state of Iran. So I got a chance to see and greet firsthand Iranians in their own setting, in their own homes. And so for me, this has been quite an interesting, not only interesting, but an enlightening experience. The conference itself brought people from all over the world. More than 100 countries were represented. So I was able to network and interact with my sister from Venezuela, my brother from Bolivia, my brothers from Africa. There were people from North America, South America, Asia, you name it, all the four corners of the planet were represented at this conference. And the thing that brought us together was our singular interest in peace and justice.
Now, what you've just talked about is interesting, talking about peace and justice, because a lot of times in the international community, the way the Islamic Republic of Iran is portrayed would probably be the antithesis of that. So tell me about that. The global opinion right now in general, when looking at the Islamic Republic of Iran and, for example, holding a terrorism or anti-terrorism conference, your take on that?
Well, of course, there are people, particularly in the United States, with which I'm most familiar, who would say, how ironic that Tehran would be the sponsor of an anti-terrorism conference, because there are people who say that Iran is a state sponsor of terrorism. And yet, even as I was in various airports on my way here and had the opportunity to meet with Iranians who live, diaspora Iranians, it is clear that the people of Iran have one thing in mind, and that is that they are a revolutionary state. And as a revolutionary state, they understand colonialism, neocolonialism, imperialism. They understand being under the foot of oppression and occupation, even if it's mental occupation, from an outside force or outside power. And that is what centers the resistance. The people who would label these individuals and this state that protects these individuals as terrorist state, generally speaking, are the entities that are promoting the very policies that even I disagree with at home.
Well, let's look at home, as you say, in the United States, and what is happening in the political arena these days. There are lots of talks about possibly a lot of Americans are looking at a third party, are looking for an option out of the Republican and the Democratic parties, and wanting something different. What do you attribute that to, first of all? And do you think it will happen that a third party or independent parties can really become a voice in the United States?
Well, there is tremendous pressure inside the political process to make sure that the voters stay aligned inside either the Democrat or Republican parties. Why? because both of those parties have been captured by special interests. And those special interests are, quite frankly, the antithesis of the interests of the people. And so therefore, for example, if people in the United States care about education, but unfortunately there's a banker that gets in between the student and the student's ability to go to school, if they care about health care, there's the insurance industry that gets in between the patient and the doctor who is seeking to provide care. And so we have all of these special interests that have positioned themselves in between the political decision makers and the people themselves. The process now is more responsive to those special interests than it is to the values and the wishes of the American people. When the American people then decide that they are sick and tired of this kind of configuration, the only place to go so that one's values have the likelihood or the opportunity to become policy is outside of the corral that has been built for you. And an interesting example is the Tea Party. The people of the Tea Party were originally angry about the direction of their country. And who wouldn't be angry at the direction that the United States has taken now? They initially said that they would vote neither Democrat nor Republican, that they were independent voters. And then what happened? The powers that be sent Sarah Palin in and corralled this group, this nascent group of independent voters, and captured them again for the Republican Party.
So are you saying this is basically how it's done? Even if there's an independent voice, then basically that voice is not going to be heard in the way perhaps those individuals, the grassroots movements, wants it to be heard, but basically it's hijacked at the end for a certain agenda or what? Tell me.
Well, it was definitely hijacked. The whole Tea Party apparatus was hijacked and then corralled back into the Republican Party fold so that these could then stay where the powers that be would like them to be.
So let me say, with you, because you served in the Congress, the U.S. Congress, and obviously you were representing a certain district in Georgia, and I believe that parts of it was a very deprived area. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
So you go there, you have a certain agenda for the people that you want to make their voice heard.
Yes.
And serve their interests. Are you allowed to actually do that? Tell me about the process itself as far as when serving as a member of Congress.
Well, the district that I initially represented in Congress, I represented so many districts because redistricting was a tool that was used to target me, to eliminate me from the Congress. But the district that initially sent me there was a district that was comprised of rural blacks in the Black Belt of Georgia. These are people who have not had access to equal opportunity at all. And in fact, when I went into that district, I found such poverty that I didn't even know existed in my own country. I had people in my district who did not have running water in their homes. And I'm talking about 1992. I'm talking about
really?
A district where the members of the Ku Klux Klan regularly threatened blacks and even threatened my supporters to the extent that they had shots fired at them. I was told that I needed to get out of town before it got dark. I mean, this is pre-civil rights movement
yes.
type of stuff. And that's the kind of atmosphere that existed. But what we were able to do in the short 4 years that I represented that particular area is that we were able to bring whites to the table. We were able to challenge those practices that were not acceptable. We were able to bring blacks into areas of power that they never never in their wildest dreams thought that they could possess and own. And then the district was dismantled.
Why was that? What does that mean?
The district was challenged in the Supreme Court. And with the assistance of the Anti-Defamation League, the district was dismantled. It generally takes about $250,000 minimum to take a case from filing up to the Supreme Court. And the people who filed the lawsuit to dismantle, they challenged my ability to represent the people of that particular district.
Who were these people?
Well, actually, interestingly, there were five white citizens, one of whom had been the white male candidate that I defeated in the Democratic primary. And they were aided and abetted by the Anti-Defamation League. And when the case arrived at the Supreme Court, interestingly, on the same day as an environmental case, the spotted owl case, the Supreme Court decided that the habitat for the spotted owl should be protected, but that the black voters in that district could have no protection. And so the district was dismantled.
Now, let's talk about when you were actually serving, Cynthia. Did you feel that a lot of your programs or what you were trying to get through, that you could actually make a difference? Was there any kind of interference, or were you basically allowed to be the free thinker that you are?
When the matter pertained to my constituency, of course, my leadership style was different, and it took a lot of getting used to. But it takes 218 votes in the House of Representatives to pass anything. And therefore, once one crosses the threshold into the chamber, then everyone is basically kind of treated the same, particularly when your vote is needed to pass important legislation. Therefore, I was actually able to deliver a lot. In fact, my former constituents are still spending the money that I was able to bring back to them, because I wrote stipulations into the law that generally what would happen is that money would be obtained for one goal or use, and then it would be, you know, siphoned off for something else. And I would write in there, they said I was interfering with local jurisdiction, but I would write in the legislation that it could only be used to service these constituents. And that's why even today they're still spending money that I got a decade ago.
Well, let's talk about Cynthia. There are many reports that talks about the influence of the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, on United States politics in general. Did you experience anything in that realm as far as what one would call the interference in American policy by AIPAC?
Well, it's interesting, because when I first went to Congress, I did not go to Congress to pay particular attention to any area outside of the black community that I represented that was in need. And, of course, U.S.-Africa policy, which was abhorrent and unfortunately still is. But what I ran into, I bumped into at almost every turn, were these special interests. And there's no more special interest that has any more influence than the pro-Israel lobby. And so then when I did outreach, for example, to the Muslim community in the United States, I bumped into the pro-Israel lobby, which of course does not want to have to contend with a politicized Muslim community, which is as large as and is as wealthy as the pro-Israel lobby is in the United States. So yes, first-handedly and also frontally was assaulted by the presence of the pro-Israel lobby to such an extent.
Physically assaulted?
Well, politically assaulted.
Okay.
To such an extent that my father had to ask the question publicly, what does Stone Mountain, Georgia have to do with Israel? What I was doing was servicing the needs of my constituents, and I was not allowed to do that because I did not toe the line on U.S. policy for Israel.
What line is that that they wanted? Were you told directly that you had to toe a line, or explain that to me?
Well, every candidate for Congress at that time had a pledge. They were given a pledge to sign. And I was new on the scene. And so the pledge had Jerusalem as the capital city, the military superiority of Israel.
American Congress people have to sign this pledge.
Yes, you sign the pledge. If you don't sign the pledge, you don't get money. So, for example, it was almost like water torture for me. My parents observed this. I would get a call, and the person on the other end of the phone would say, I want to do a fundraiser for you. And then we would get into the planning. I would get really excited because, of course, you have to have money in order to run a campaign. And then 2 weeks, 3 weeks into the planning, they would say, did you sign the pledge? And then I would say, no, I didn't sign the pledge. And then my fundraiser would go kaput.
So, well, I just want to get into this pledge a little bit more. So this is basically something that is mandatory, that every congressperson has to sign, saying that, what, Jerusalem, you said, is the capital of Israel, and what else?
You make a commitment that you will vote to support the military superiority of Israel, that the economic assistance that Israel wants, that you would vote to provide that.
This isn't a question for the Congress people serving, that they are representing, or they're supposed to be representing, the people of the United States, not a foreign country, and yet they have to pledge allegiance
yes.
to a foreign state.
That's what
no
I
one
was,
questions this.
That's what I was asked to do. And I made it public. This probably nobody had said anything about it, but I made it public. And then, you know, the excuse was, well, you know, those were just overzealous advocates for Israel. So then the tactic changed. And but this is what is done for 535 members of the United States Congress. 100 senators, 435 members of the House of Representatives have to now write a paragraph, which basically says the same thing. So it's not a pledge, but it's a paragraph, and you post it, and, you know, there are these forums you have to go to at the synagogues or whatever. And then, you know, if you don't perform appropriately, then you don't get money to run your campaign. The problem is that it requires an awful lot of money to run a campaign. And whether it's a woman's organization, an environmental organization, people can read about this on the internet if they're interested. If you go to thomas.loc.gov, that is the official United States Congress website. And if you put in the name Gus Savage, because Gus Savage was a black member of Congress who was targeted by the pro-Israel lobby. And he had the foresight to use his position as an incumbent in the House of Representatives to put his experience on the congressional record for the entire existence of the United States Congress now. People will be able to access his experience. And what he wrote was that it was the Garden Club of New Jersey that gave his opponent $5,000. But it wasn't really the Garden Club of New Jersey. It was the activists who were associated with AIPAC. The okay. American Israel Public Affairs Committee.
Wow. Unbelievable, but we're almost out of time, so I just want to get into a little bit of your personal experience now and what you're planning. So you had told me earlier that you were basically, you did not win the last election, or basically it was because of the Zionist lobby, from what I understood, that basically forced you or not allowed you to get reelected. And now you have future plans, though, to try to run again. Tell me about it, and tell me why you think that it will make a difference.
Well, I have, because of the notoriety about me telling my story, and then, of course, the public positions that I've taken, supporting the human rights aspirations, the legitimate rights and the aspirations of the Palestinian people, I have a target on my forehead. And that then means that every means that is available to the pro-Israel lobby will be utilized to make sure that I do not ever occupy a position of authority. Now, fortunately for me, there is a very large peace community that is interested in change, and they would like to have a tested, experienced voice representing them in that very hall of Congress so that they can at least have their voices heard, even if they can't change the policy. But being there is the first step to having the policy changed. The problem for me is that it will require an awful lot of money in order to, I don't need to match the others, because I have the advantage of being able to amass and organize people power. But even with people power, you still have to have enough to cover the basics of a viable campaign.
And we're talking about a lot of money.
Well, we're talking a minimum of $500,000. And with $1 million, I know that, you know, we would be able to do great things.
Okay. Well, we wish you all the best. And thank you so much for being with us, Ms. Cynthia McKinney.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, viewers, for joining us in another Face to Face. Goodbye.